fricative sound. The English J and CH are fricative palatals. These palatals produce a sound by the slow release of a consonant followed immediately by a fricative. Examples are the voiceless CH in batch. We use these terms all the time and never think about it. Why should we? We drive cars, we're not mechanics. We use we have wiring in our house, we're not electricians. We run water and we're not plumbers. Sometimes we have to become that. So we don't think about it, but this is our language that we mimic when, as youngsters, we hear the sound. As little bitty tots, we begin to form the sounds imitating our parents and those around us. And so if you're from Chicago, it's Chicago. Use guys. You don't think anything of it. Or Toledo has maybe a little different accent, parts of Detroit, New York especially, and Brooklyn, or some of the famous accents there. California is very neutral. And of course the famous southern accents with all the variations of the vowels going all the way across from the east coast to Texas. Well, those sounds developed from a few tiny places in colonial days and spread out westward across the country. You can trace them. Linguists can trace them right up into Wisconsin and Minnesota and clear across into the plains and all the way down through the south and then into the west. We imitate the sound, and the physical character just is symbolic of that imitated sound. So all Hebrew grammars in Tyndale's day, and this is the Tyndale translated from 15, or period of about 12 years, from 1520 to 1522 to about 1534 or so, before he was imprisoned. He never completed his work. The final translation was completed by his friend Coverdale. So all Hebrew grammars in Tyndale's day used the Sephardic phonic system that we were just talking about, where the jot was classified as a palatal. Ja, the sound. That is why Tyndale gave the Hebrew letter J, or jot rather, the sound J. There was no great conspiracy. All Hebraists at that time used the same sound, as we'll see, especially when we get into the interesting history of who was Gallatinus. And the real detective work begins, and it will show you how all this was covered up. We can actually trace the sordid history of the lies that were just passed on from generation to generation among so-called scholars, and they were all Catholic. So you know who they loved and hated. Jesuit Catholics who were out to destroy English Protestantism, English language in particular. And I believe that truly believe the main reason God gave us America was to keep his promise to Israel, but in particular, a special promise to Joseph. I believe God preserved his word through Joseph and passed it on and amplified it, published it, and sent it around the world through Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, Great Britain and the United States of America. This they have to destroy. By the way, since the 20s or 30s, maybe perhaps earlier, more Jesuits are produced out of America than any other country in the world. More Jesuits come out of America than any place else in the world. European Jews, and most Jews today, have been taught that the Hebrew alphabet has no letter for the J sound. And they'll argue, well, I go to synagogue, I've studied the Hebrew a bit, and I see the characters here, and they don't have that sound, and here's this character, it means this. They don't realize the history that goes back just a few years before this, and back into the Sephardic history. Ashkenazi leaders have passed on the myth for a long time that the Sephardic Jews were the hillbillies of Judaism. They were the scholars. They were the main scholars, the main preservers of God's word. Those who loved the Hebrew and preserved it. Wrote the grammars. Taught the Protestant scholars. So when God transferred the Hebrew and the Greek over into the Protestant community, the Jewish community felt that Christianity was being destroyed. They willingly participated with Catholics, hoping that they would destroy Christianity, that is, Catholicism. That's the only Christianity they knew. And what happens 10, 20, 30 years down the road? All Germany is converted to Lutheranism. France is converted, all the way up into Poland, up into Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. So over in toward Russia, way up into Scandinavian countries, over into England. All that's left is a part of Italy and Spain. So the Jews and the Catholics are both horrified. they join in an effort now to destroy Protestantism. But the Protestants now have the grammars. They've inherited the truth of hundreds of years. They've inherited the Hebrew scripture, or its guardian. They inherited the Greek, the literal Greek. They're the guardians of the Greek and the Hebrew. And they have it in English and German. Of course, the English and German as languages and as peoples are cousins. So overnight, tens or hundreds of millions of people, out of their control, suddenly have the word in their laps. And lo and behold, some of these fools get on these little ships and go to America. Then it really gets out of hand. These people read the Bible, take it seriously, found a new country, kick out the Brits, America becomes the bastion of Protestantism. And then, and only then, do you have Sabbatarianism beginning to flourish. And it started in Michigan. That's where it first took root and then started to spread. And so I think it's ironic that they're coming back into Michigan now through Andrews University to try to bring it to an end. The Jesuits are trying to retrace their tracks, bring it back in through Andrews, and destroy the remaining elements of Sabbatarianism. What has God done again to Sabbatarian groups? You're one of them. He brought his wonderful hand down, scattered us, and what's happening? They have no idea who we are, where we are. Literature is popping up all over the place. There are groups that are independent fellowships that they can't possibly get control of because we know and love each other. We're a Christian cell. We know our fruits. We know when we get up and when we go to bed. We know each other as people. What's the hardest group to break into on the face of the earth? This is what God's doing again to preserve His Word. And I know we get very discouraged. All of us do. I do myself at times. And I have to remind myself that in God's hand to correct us, that on the other side of that, there is a great blessing. And His Word will be preached regardless of what these fools, other fools do. They're fools. Every time they think they got God by the throat, they can't. God's Word and His work just slips out and just spreads all over the place like some kind of spiritual virus. And that's happening again. But this Ashkenazic pronunciation of Jot, used by all Jews and German and Polish, of Polish descent, is not the original pronunciation of this Hebrew letter. As Justinius attests, the pronunciation of Hebrew by the modern German Jews, the Ashkenazi, now Justinius was a great Hebraist, a German, Jewish background. He was a Talmudist, probably a Kabbalist, but he wrote the great philological works that became the essence of the grammars that we've inherited today, the lexicons, which partly resembles the Syriac and is generally called Polish. Now I should back up here because I'm starting a quote. As Justinius attests, quote, "The pronunciation of Hebrew by the modern German Jews, that is the Ashkenazi, which partly resembles the Syriac and is generally called Polish, differs considerably from that of the Spanish and Portuguese Jews, that is the Sephardic, which approaches nearer to the Arabic. The pronunciation of Hebrew by Christians follows the latter." Now this was first written at the turn of the 1800s, back in 1812, 1814, by Justinius, whose teacher was Malchaeus, in a town, a university town called Halle, Germany. Malchaeus defended to his death, this is Justinian's teacher, that the vowel markings under Jehovah are the accurate markings. Justinius picked up on Judaism and began to write against the vowel markings, not against the consonants. There was no evidence given against the consonants until the 1980s and 90s. And that began to be published out of Germany, just before they transferred all that over here. And this was after the example of Reuchlin, in almost all cases. Reuchlin was the father of Christian grammars. He wrote the first Christian grammar in German, and of course the Hebrew. And he lived at the time of Tyndale. He lived at the time of Reuchlin. He lived at the time of Gallatinus and others who were the scholars, Catholic or Protestant or whatever. And we have to remember that from 1517 on up into a good part of that century, The Catholics never really viewed Protestants as Protestants, and Protestants didn't view themselves as Protestants. Catholics felt the Protestants were Catholics, and many Protestants felt they were still part of that Catholic experience. They hadn't defined it that well. They knew that there was a split and there were major differences. They were going away from the Pope, but they had not yet defined it as we think of Protestant and Catholic as we look back in history. So it was a great period. All these people knew each other. They all recognized and used the term Jehovah at that time. Even though some grew up as Italians, some as Germans, some as English, some as Spanish, it was Jehovah to all of them because that's the way it was marked in the Hebrew. In the days of Justinius, no reputable scholar challenged the authority of the Sephardic pronunciation of Jot as J. Grushin, recognized as the leading authority of that era, followed the Sephardic pronunciation of this Hebrew letter. When Tyndale transliterated the Jot of J-H-V-H and the J sound to be read as Jehovah, he did so after the example of Ruchlin. Now, myth number three. As you can see, I'll not get through. Yes. Okay, myth number three. The name Jehovah was invented. This the sacred namers really crow about. And I think they do themselves a great disfavor by crowing so loud as to quote the occult scholars at the turn of the century who write that the name Jehovah is monstrous, is a hybrid name, it is hideous, everything but bestial, and some of them has probably written about that at the turn of the century. That is not God's mind. His name was marked from the very beginning of the pointings to be pronounced as Jehovah. Now, does that make Jehovah a sacred name? No. So why are the argument on our side? We're simply arguing that Jehovah is a legitimate name for the God of the Old Testament. That's all. It's not sacred. But there's nothing wrong with the term Jehovah. Nothing sacred about the Yah sound or nothing sinful about the J sound. That's not the point. When we write about the God of the Old Testament, we have the responsibility of using God's name properly, and at that time, the transliteration out of the Hebrew into English is Jehovah. We should use that. Nothing wrong with that at all. On the other side of the coin, Yahweh is an imposter. Truly is a monstrous name, truly is hybrid, truly is hideous, and should not be used by us because I can trace and have traced it back through Gnostic records, back through at the time of Christ and shortly after. Those who, Gnostics, Jews, and Gentiles alike, who claim to be of the way of Cain, remember Jude writing about the way of Cain? They use the name Yahweh, and I can prove it. They didn't use the name Jehovah. The Christians were using the name Jehovah when they referred to the God of the Old Testament, and I can prove that. So on the one hand, Jehovah is not a sacred name. It's a divine name. We can use it, and we should. Yahweh, on the other hand, should not be used for the God of the Old, or Yahshua for the God of the New. This is what exposing these myths is all about. So in arguing against the use of Jehovah, sacred namers claim that this name was unknown in biblical times. They insist that the name Jehovah is a recent invention, concocted in the 1500s by a Catholic priest. Now, pray tell, how did Tyndale, who came out of England as a young man in his 20s and he's on fire for God and he's translating in Germany, running for his life because Martin Luther had just nailed his 95 theses to the door. There is a Wittenberg. And Tyndale, who had spent a year with up there at Wittenberg with Luther in Germany, was a hunted man. Hunted man by the Crown of England and by the Catholic Church. So as they write, if the name Jehovah was invented by a Catholic priest, how in the world did this poor man Jehovah, before he died, running through Europe, being hunted down like... What did I say?
Jehovah.
Yeah. Thank you, dear. Another reason she sits next to me to make these corrections now before I can repent at the table here before I have to repent in a letter later on. It's Tyndale, who was being driven from pillar to post in Germany, had to flee, he and his friends, out of the printers of Köln, Germany, while the agents were of the Crown were coming in the front door. They were going out the back with their materials, getting on a ship, quickly paying for passage, going up the Rhine to Worms, Germany, which was a main Jewish area for the Sephardic Jews, where he'd studied a bit of Hebrew, and continuing his work in other places, mainly in the city of Marburg, where the Saxon Duke, was protecting him. They were capitalists, by the way. And one of the interesting stories there is many of these dukes and capitalists, after the Bible was translated and printed and out, lost their power, lost their money, lost their little kingdoms. They were just there to transmit God's word through the pass before the Indians cut everything off, before it was too late. How could he have ever gotten in touch with any Catholic to pass this word Jehovah on to him that's supposedly invented by a Catholic priest when it wasn't even an issue at that time? As Anse just said, why would Tyndale accept this in this mess from any Catholic at this point, especially an agent of the Pope? And Gallatinus was the Pope's confessor, which meant that they got in a little box, and the Pope told Gallatinus how his golf game was going, or whatever. I mean that in seriously in one sense, because the Pope at that time was Giovanni de Medici, out of Florence, one of the most liberal popes of the era. They would walk down the streets of Rome with their mistresses and sometimes their misters. They had both. And openly flaunting all this sin before the people of Rome, their own people. Of course, this pope was one of the main leverages for the Reformation. Anyway, good point, and it's a very good point. Now, they quote well-known biblical writers and editors who support this view. As I said before, these were Catholic Jesuits who had professing to be Protestants. Remember, the Jesuits will lie and pretend to be anything and do anything and will commit any sin to do the will of their God. This is the vow that they take. In the introduction, this is a quote, to the emphasized Bible, editor Joseph Rotherham writes, quote, the pronunciation Jehovah was unknown until 1520, when it was introduced by Gallatinus, but was contested by Le Mercier, J. Drusius, and L. Capellus as against grammatical and historical propriety. Now, this is a quote within a quote. I took this from pages 24 through 25 of a booklet published in Missouri entitled The Mistaken J. On page 17 of that booklet. I brought the Rotherham Bible with me. This is a sacred name Bible. This is what they use. This is where it was Rotherham who first wrote that God's name in the Old Testament, the divine name, was sacred, that it had been suppressed, and it must now be liberated. His name is Yahweh, and that we must correct for hundreds of years of defiling God's name. He went to the text for the Greek from Westcott and Hort. They were occultists. They were Jesuits, Protestant professing scholars who led the scholarly world away from the Greek of the King James Version. They also professed the perverted Hebrew of the synagogue of the rabbinic Hebrew and began to rewrite the Masoretic text. He does it in this Bible. So this is truly monstrous as a Bible. This is truly a hybrid version. This is where they get it. This is the main Bible of the sacred namers. They quote him over and over and over again. Of course, they started their work in 1930 in Detroit, of all places, and the sacred name movement has spread and spread and spread and spread, and is now beginning to just impact our people in a major way. Sacred namers believe that they have the real facts concerning the name Jehovah because a number of sources support this view. Foremost among these sources is the Jewish Encyclopedia, which states, quote, the reading Jehovah is a comparatively recent invention. Jehovah is generally held to have been the invention of Pope Leo X's confessor, Peter Gallatin. And then they mentioned the article in which Gallatin wrote. It's simply, the Latin simply means he's defending the truth of the ancient Catholic Church. That's simply what it means. It was actually published in 1516. The Jewish Encyclopedia has it wrong. They have 1518. Later they say 1520, so they can't make up their minds. Who was followed in the use of this hybrid form by Fagius Drusius of Vanderdriesch, that's Dutch, I I can't roll the R, who lived between 1550 and 1616, was the first to ascribe to Peter Gallatin the use of Jehovah, and this view has been taken since his days. This is a quote from the Jewish Encyclopedia under the article Jehovah. Now, it is true that the name Jehovah was invented by... Oh, is it true, rather? Thank you, dear. Is it true? Question. That the name Jehovah was invented by a Catholic priest named Gallatin or Gallatinus? Or is this view of scholars itself an invention? Let us examine other historical and biblical sources to shed more light on this subject. And this is where it really gets interesting. Believe me, this has been an incredible detective story, and as this thing has unfolded, I couldn't believe my eyes. The hypocrisy, the deception, the lies that have been passed down, and how easy it is to deceive people who don't check the records. How easy it is to begin to bury the records to the point where they're almost lost. I believe that the remaining records that we have in the Protestant world will be allowed to disintegrate into dust or burned or destroyed or passed, you know, just taken out of the libraries in the next few years. For several years now, I've been researching it at the James White Library at Andrews University. It's only about 15 minutes from my house. Depending on the weather, I can be there in 15, 20 minutes. I've noticed over the last few years that the main seminary library is going downhill. It's falling apart. They're not keeping the books up, and these are the books from which I got this information, among others. The encyclopedic works that were written at the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, that go back into the German and English literature and verify these things. When those works go, we will have none of this. We will have none of it. And we're this close, just a gnat's blinking of an eye, to those works being destroyed. Unless somebody preserves them on discs or copies them. If I had the money and the time, I would hire someone to go into the libraries and copy everything, digitize it, preserve it and pass it on. I don't have the money and the time. God hasn't called me to do that, so I'm trusting Him for somebody else to do that and praying to that end. Who then was Gallatinus? When I made a tape a year and a half ago or 2 years ago in Detroit at a little fellowship up there, I pronounced his name Gallatinus instead of the Latin Gallatinus because it sounded very much like the money that the Ferengi use for their Ferengi Empire on Star Trek, like the metal. So I was making a little bit of fun of the name. A sacred name wrote me back, totally misunderstood, the same fellow from Atlanta, Texas, totally misunderstood that I had never seen the quote. I had seen the quote. I know the invention of the name is attributed to Gallatinus. I wanted to know who this man was. No sacred namer had ever told me. No one gave me any source to which I could go other than the source that said, hey, this guy invented the name. So I wanted to find out more about him. So I did. And what a story. The real name of Peter Gallatin, and you'll see it either Gallatin or Gallatinus, or Petrus Gallatinus, his Latin name is Pietro Colonna Gallatino. He's an Italian. Now the Colonna family, you can go to the Catholic Encyclopedia, a 1912 edition, and under the name Colonna, you'll find they were a very wealthy merchant family, very powerful politically and religiously, and there's no difference at that time. So here's a very powerful man. He's not a backwoodser. He's at the top of the heap of the hierarchy of the world at this time, even becomes the confessor to Pope Leo X.
Let me ask.
So here's a brief summary of his life, that is Gallatinus, in work as stated in the Catholic Encyclopedia. Quote, Gallatino Pietro Colonna, and I've inserted here alias Petrus Gallatinus, that's his Latin name. So these men went by Italian names, Greek names, Latin names, German names. They had four or five aliases, same person. It was common at this time. Now let me insert here, this is not one of the myths I'm attacking, exposing. The sacred namers will tell you that God's name is a personal name, and all names, when they're transliterated into another language, remain the same. They never change. If it's Joe from one language, it's Joe and Joe and Joe and Joe and Joe all the way through the languages. They use this argument for Yahweh. You know, that God's name is personal, which it isn't, and that is transliterated literally. Well, if that's so, why can't you find anybody in history who did that? So it's another myth, and this is another way of exposing that. That's not true. my name Carl in other languages would be Charles. You know, same meaning, but it would be a different, or Carlos.
What about John?
Or John, yeah, John and everything else. Johann, indeed. He was Friar Minor, philosopher, theologian, orientalist. So this man was a well-educated person. He'd been schooled. He had not just walked out of the barn the day before. He was born at Galatia, Lacazzazzo, at Apulia, died at Rome soon after 1539, received the habit as early as 1480. Now, I don't know whether that meant it was tobacco or what, but he received the habit at that time. Thanks, hon. He studied Oriental languages in Rome and was appointed lector at the convent of Aracoli. He also held the office of provincial in the province of Bari. That's way down by the heel, across from around the Adriatic, in that province, and that of penitentiary or confessor under Leo X. Galatino wrote his chief work, De Arcanis Catholicae Veritatis. That's the Latin simply, and I butchered that, but it's the Latin for defense of the ancient Catholic teaching. That's all, their doctrine. At the request of the Pope and Emperor, this is Maximilian up in Germany, and other dignitaries in 1516, at which time, owing mainly to John Ruchlin, remember me mentioning the fellow who was the first Christian grammarian? This is the father of Christian grammatics, and he received his information from Sephardism. Well, Ruchlin wrote a little booklet called the Augenspiegel. The famous controversy on the authority of the Jewish writings was assuming a very menacing aspect. They were arguing over whether or not to destroy the Talmud and the Kabbalistic writings. Galatino took up Ruchlin's defense. Resolved to combat the Jews on their own ground, he turned the Kabbalah against them and sought to convince them that their own books yielded ample proof of the truth of the Christian religion. Hence their opposition to it should be branded as obstinacy. He gave his work the form of a dialogue. This is based on the style of Plato and Aristotle and the other early Greek writers. The two conflicting Christian parties were represented by Capnio, that is the Italian name of Ruchlin, and the Inquisitor Hochstraten, out of Germany, OP. Now, he was the Inquisitor for the representative up there of the Inquisition out of Spain. The two conflicting Christian, in conciliatory terms, Galatino responded to the queries and suggestions of the former and refuted the objection of the latter. So he was on Ruchlin's side and refuted the work, the teachings of those of the Inquisition. He had borrowed largely from the Pugio Fidei of the Dominican Raymond Martini, remodeling, however, the material and supplementing it with copious quotations from the Zohar, the Kabbalistic work of the Jews of a few centuries before, and the Galarazzaya, that's another Kabbalistic work. So these men were familiar with Kabbalism, they were familiar with the Talmud, they were familiar with the writings of the Catholic Church. Well, in Pugio Fidei, a monk who had written in the late 1200s out of Spain, the word Jehovah, as it appears, all but the ending H, in Tyndale's transliteration, is in those writings. So the point is, if Galatino himself uses the word Jehovah that he'd copied from Pugio Fidei, Martini's work of 1280-something, how could he have invented the word? See what I mean? It's as simple as that. Now that we have learned more about Galatinus, they write, let us look at the assertion that he invented the name Jehovah. If Galatinus had invented the name Jehovah, why not have... Jehovah would not have been known before his time. Just simple logic. Yet, it is a historical fact that the name Jehovah was known and used centuries before Galatinus finished his work of 1516. Notice, quote, but the writers of the 16th century, Catholic and Protestant, and I'll skip some of these names, other than to mention that Cajetan was a very high cardinal who was tapped by Pope Leo X to combat Luther's teachings and writings. What they're saying here is, this man also knew of the form Jehovah. So from the top of the Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, the Sephardic, the form Jehovah was being used. And Theodore de Beza. Now Beza, I probably should say Beza, was the not only the a great Reformation scholar, but probably the leading at the toward the end of the time period, the end of the 1500s, as they were beginning to form the and finalize the King James Bible of 1611. It was his work that was most influential in deciding on the Greek and the Hebrew and the various touchy places where the translations which should be used. So these were known all over Europe. They knew all of, they knew the scripture and knew the Hebrew and knew the Greek. This man had written earlier, but his work was used later. In other words, at the time of Galatino, this man was known as a Protestant out of Switzerland, I believe, and was a scholar of the highest repute. And so they're writing here, this Protestant scholar and this Catholic scholar, Gadgetan, the Catholic scholar, and Beza, the Protestant scholar, are perfectly familiar with the word Jehovah. Gelatinus himself, in his writing of 1516, represents the form as known and received in his time, very commonly known. Besides, Drusius discovered it in Porcetus. Now, the man Drusius really becomes extremely interesting in the Levitical connections, Jesuit connections later on. Drusius was a theologian of the, or Porcetus rather, was a theologian of the 14th century. Finally, the word is found even in the Pugio Fidei, the Dagger of Faith, of Raymond Martin, a work written in 1270. Probably the introduction of the name Jehovah antedates even R. Martin, and I have references of scholars today who say it probably goes back to the 900s. Well, it fits perfectly with the Masoretes coming out of Palestine at the time of the first crusade across North Africa by ship, showing up in Moorish Spain and setting up shop, bringing with them the already pointed Hebrew text and preserving it, writing the grammars, all that was inherited by the time of Tyndale into the Protestant world. Historical records clearly demonstrate that the name Jehovah was known centuries before the time of Gelatinus. How then did the myth develop that Gelatinus invented the name? Let's take a closer look at this claim as presented in the Jewish Encyclopedia. Quote, the reading Jehovah is a comparatively recent invention, they write. Jehovah is generally held to have been the invention of Pope Leo X's confessor, Peter Gallatin, who was followed in the use of this hybrid form by Fagius Drusius. Now remember the name Fagius Drusius. This is really interesting. Van der Driesch, who lived between 1550 and 1616, was the first to ascribe to Peter Gallatin the use of Jehovah, and his view has been taken since his days. Yes, it has, because the Catholic and Jesuit and the Protestant Jesuits have perpetrated and resurrected these quotes and hidden the truth. Article Jehovah, Jewish Encyclopedia. In this article, the Jewish Encyclopedia states that a man named Van der Driesch was the first to link the name Jehovah to the works of Gelatinus. But at the same time, the use of Jehovah was supported by a man named Fagius Drusius, a Latin name for whoever this person was. Who were these men and what shaped their views? When we delve into historical records of the time, we find that the Jewish Encyclopedia has mistakenly combined the names Fagius and Drusius, and that these names actually belong to two different men. Now, interjection of a point here. So much for the scholarship, right? We better read these things with open eyes and with a little bit of concern, because they pass these things on to us, and they just believe it's true that they've done their scholarship, and indeed they've given us a snow job. The man who was known by the Latin name Paulus Fagius was the German scholar Paul Büchlin. The man known as Drusius, also known as Van der Driesch, was the Dutch theologian Johann Clemens. Both men lived in the 1500s, but Fagius died a year before the birth of Drusius. Well. Reincarnation, yes. Thank you, Anse. Thank you. So, I flipped the page too soon here. Let us examine the lives of these two men, to learn the circumstances that shape their opposing views of the name Jehovah. Let's take Phagius first of all. Alias Paulus Phagius, alias Paul Bushlin, 1504 to 1549. As you can see, he didn't live very long, but he was a personal friend of Ruchlin and Luther, and was a famous German scholar, raised a German, but supported the pronunciation Jehovah, even though the J sound isn't in his native language. As the Encyclopedia Judaica relates, Phagius, whose real name was Paul Bushlin, was a professor of Hebrew who had studied under the great Elijah Levita. And then there's a quote here. May I interject that Elijah Levita was the last and the greatest of all the Sephardic grammarians. He took all the work of the previous 500 years and passed it on to the Protestants. He was from Spain. He worked with Bushlin and Bushlin's printing shop in Germany, Disney, Germany. The quote, Phagius Paulus, or Paulus Phagius, Paul Bushlin, Hebraist, born at Rheinsabern in the Palatinate, Germany, it's over toward France and Switzerland. He was professor of Hebrew first at Strasbourg and later at Cambridge, England. He learned Hebrew from Elijah Levita, and I believe Elijah's last name really means Levite, shortened to the Levita, whom he invited to supervise the Hebrew press he established in Isne, or in Bavaria. Bushlin translated the following Hebrew books into Latin: Elijah Levita's Tishbe, which has to do with the grammar, and Mater Gaiman in 1542, the Talmud Tractate Avot, 1541. He edited a Hebrew version of the Book of Tobit with a Latin translation, 1542, the Alphabet of Ben-Sir, 1542, and David Kimmies, another great grammarian of a few centuries before, commentary on Psalm 110. Now there's an extra zero in there. Take the first zero out. It's not 10:10. It should be Psalm 110. And scratch it out in your material, so, or opaque it or whatever, so whenever you copy it and pass it on, it'll be corrected. Thank you. He edited several chapters of Targum Onkelos. Now these are written in Aramaic, and they're paraphrases, in other words, expressing their opinion of what the Hebrew means in the given community, the Jewish community at a given time. And wrote an exegetic treatise on the first four chapters of Genesis, 1542. He was the author of an elementary Hebrew grammar, 1543, and of two books in which he endeavored, with reference to Jewish sources, to prove the truth of Christianity. Mistake. You go to the Hebrew and the Greek to do, and the English from those to do that. He began the republication of a revised edition of the Concordance by his name, Mir Natif. After his migration to England, where he died, his work was completed by Ruchlin at Basel, 1556. We find additional information about the life and work of Phagius, or Bushlin, in the new Schaff-Herzog Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge, which states that he also studied under the renowned Ruchlin. He was a, quote, German theologian, born at Rheinsabern, Rhenish Bavaria, 1504, died at Cambridge, 1549, November 13th. He studied at Heidelberg and at Strasbourg, where Capito, that is Johann Ruchlin, taught him Hebrew. So he studied Hebrew under Levita and also Ruchlin, the two greatest scholars of the time. He became rector of the school at Isne, 1527, and was a student of theology at Strasbourg. Now this is 10 years, 1527, after the Reformation began. This was in Reformation Germany. He was a Protestant theologian, a native German. He was a student of theology at Strasbourg. 1535, returned as the evangelical pastor at Isne in Bavaria, 1537, and became pupil in Hebrew of Elias Levita. He succeeded Capito as pastor and theological professor in Strasbourg, 1542. Violently opposed to the interim, that's a tract that was written, when it was introduced in 1549, he accepted Cranmer's invitation to England, to come to England, and became professor of Hebrew at Cambridge, and soon died of a fever. Under Queen Mary, a Catholic English queen out of Scotland, His and Butzer's bones were exhumed and burned February 6, 1557, and their university honors were taken from them. But Queen Elizabeth ordered that the university formally restore to them their honors. July 22, 1560, Article Fagius, the new Schafferzot. So the Fagius of history was the German Hebraist Paul Bushlin, a Reformation scholar and a Protestant theologian. Bushlin was one of the leading Hebrew scholars of his generation, having studied under the greatest Hebrew Hebraist of all, Johann Ruchlin. He had also studied Hebrew under the greatest of all Sephardic Hebraists, Elias or Elijah Levita. Bushlin's expertise in biblical Hebrew was acknowledged by all Protestant scholars of his day, and his qualifications are still unquestioned by the scholarly community today. Now, for Drusius, we don't know who he is yet. But for this fellow to say that this man just came along and has willy-nilly promoted Jehovah, a hybrid name invented by Gallatinus, is really quite something to say. Besides being a lie, it's quite a bold lie that was picked up by Catholic scholars and passed on, even though Drusius was supposedly a Protestant. May I add here, we haven't gotten to Drusius yet, but Drusius was of the area of Flanders. That's the kind of Dutch he was. At that time, Drusius lived. King Philip II of Spain controlled the Netherlands, a good part of it. Now, under William of Orange, in the late 1500s, they began to revolt and break away, but that took a good many years before that was fully complete. And the upper part of around the Zuider Zee, and I forget some of the other cities from the main ports, broke away. Those principalities broke away, but the lower part of Holland, that is today Holland, was made up of a section that is part of France today is Belgium, took part of Holland to make that, and then part of it became modern Netherlands. Well, that part was still controlled by Philip of Spain and by the Spanish crown until way late into the 1600s. Yeah, they did, indeed. Some of the greatest brutality was in that area, and this was the area that the Jesuits were working at most feverishly. The Jesuits of this area were writing the Douay Rheims version of the Bible, translating it out of the Vulgate. They were also masterminding the building of and planning for the Spanish Armada. So the Pope, through the Jesuits of this region, right across from Britain, were masterminding a twofold attack through a new Bible and through the Spanish Navy coming up and recapturing England, coming in with a new Bible and taking everything back. Carolyn. All right. Based on the teaching he had received from the learned Ruchlin and the great Elias Levita, Bushlin or Fagius supported the use of Jehovah as the true pronunciation of the Hebrew name JHVH. No one could convince this leading Protestant scholar that the name Jehovah was invented, because he had been taught by the most knowledgeable Hebrew scholars of his day. He was thoroughly familiar with the letters of the Hebrew alphabet and the pronunciation of every consonant and vowel marking. His expert knowledge of the Hebrew language formed a solid basis for his use of the name Jehovah as a legitimate pronunciation of the divine name. No invention here. Historical records confirm that the man known as Fagius, in reality Paul Bushlin, leading German scholar and professor of Hebrew, was eminently qualified to evaluate the legitimacy of the name Jehovah. However, soon after the death of Fagius, another man came on the scene promoting a very different view of Jehovah. This man, known by the Latin name Drusius, was none other than the Dutch theologian Johann Clemens, also known as Van der Driesch. As quoted earlier in an article from the Jewish Encyclopedia, it was Van der Driesch who first claimed that the name Jehovah was invented by Gallatinus. Was this view of the name Jehovah based on unbiased scholarship and careful consideration of the historical facts, or was it the result of outside influences and glossing over the records of history? We'll find it was the latter. Let us investigate the life of Van der Driesch, or Drusius, that's his Latin name, to find the answer. Now, he lived from 1550 to 1616. Now, remember, the Jesuits were picking up steam from 1534. That's when they were chartered. They were by the this time they were gaining pockets of great influence in certain areas, among which Drusius, from which Drusius came. The Encyclopedia Judaica states the following, quote, Drusius von der Driesch, Johann Clemens, 1550-1616, Dutch theologian, Hebraist, and biblical scholar. Now, I think they're being generous here. How are we going to check to find out how good these people are? All they have to do is just state that these were great men and pass it on through history, and we bite that line, hook, line, and sinker, and we're dead. They've set up a straw man, an artificial scholar, in other words. A native of Oudenaarde, East Flanders, he was professor of Oriental languages at Oxford from 1572 and later at Leiden, Ghent, and Franeker. Drusius wrote, he was a Protestant theologian, okay? But that means nothing at this time because the Jesuits would willingly come in, lie claim to be Protestants, work their way in, and then take over the institution and begin to influence the writing and all the literature that came out. Drusius wrote several books on Hebrew grammar, including, I won't pronounce it, in 1587, and another grammar in 1612. He wrote a book on Elijah Levita's works, 1652, no doubt casting certain a light, certain bent in a certain direction. Was written in collaboration with his son, Johann, and many other scholars. He wrote several works on biblical exegesis. Not either the editor...